see my old friend and Dharma buddy from literally decades ago, but also to have a chance to be here with all of you. I've never visited Barrie before. I've heard about it for also decades, so it was good to have the excuse to come and have a chance to be with all of you. And Venerable Analio, who's turned out to hear my talk too, thank you very much for coming as well. I was also very glad that Anne Klein went first, because on the one hand, she sort of laid out the ontological grounding for much of what we would know also find in the East Asian Chan, Sun, or Zen tradition. These are all the same term, so I'll probably be using them interchangeably. Korean is Sun, Chinese is Chan, and the Japanese would be Zen. And we often know it in the West as Zen. So this is sort of the common ground for much of the East Asian tradition, this notion of the imminence of enlightenment, the inherency of Buddha nature in all sentient beings, she called it the open horizon that meditation creates. This is very typical, I think, of East Asian Buddhism generally, and specifically of the Sun school. But also, I think her talk was very helpful because those of you who are here, who especially come out of a Vipassana and particularly an MBSR background, were probably just as befuddled hearing her talk as I was when I first went to Korea and entered a Sun monastery. I was really inspired to start Buddhist training when I read Nyanaponika's Heart of Buddhist Meditation when I was 16 years old and decided to go off to Thailand. I was wearing robes just like Venerable Analio is right now for a year, and ended up traveling then subsequently to Korea. And so much of what I knew about Buddhism came out of the Satipatthana sort of Theravada Pali tradition. And when I arrived in Korea, it really was like Dorothy dropping into the Wizard of Oz land. Totally unlike anything I had ever experienced. It made utterly no sense to me at all what kind of practice this was. How this could even be Buddhism was really a struggle to try to understand. Fortunately, the way of life, though, was very familiar. And the monks live together. They do a lot of practice together. The environment was just idyllic for meditation training, as Martine mentioned once also. These beautiful mountain monasteries with a lot of very serious meditation practitioners around, just the perfect environment for practice. The trouble is, what is this practice they're doing anyway? And how can this possibly be Buddhist? And this was really the beginning of, in some sense, of my scholarly career, trying to make sense of all this, especially in terms that I would have known and been more familiar with from the early Indian or the Pali background. And so that's what kind of started me beginning to explore. I figured if I'm going to stay here and take really best advantage of this opportunity I have to study with these Korean Sun monks, I really need to figure out what they're doing and why they're doing it. And that's what I'm going to try to do today a bit, is to give you some sense of what this practice of Kanwasan is. And I'll talk about that in just a bit. But also, since this is a conference on Vedana, I'm going to use one of the central terms within the Kanwasan tradition, the notion of the sensation of doubt, as sort of my entry point here. Now, we're moving across a very vast cultural and linguistic boundary, going from the Indic cultural linguistic spheres of the Indian subcontinent and Central Asia, across the Taklamakan Desert into China, and eventually into Korea and Vietnam and Japan. Fortunately, though, all these countries use as a common language sinographs. They use a literary Chinese written language. And the Koreans also wrote throughout their history in classical Chinese, in fact. So when we talk about Korean Buddhism or Chinese Buddhism or Japanese Buddhism, fortunately, there is in large measure a common language that we use across these traditions. And this is why I say I'm going to often be switching between probably Korean and Chinese terms, especially Zen, Chan, Sun. They're all really the same thing. So forgive me if I do that. We know in the Sinosphere that we do have a standard technical term, which is a translation of this Indian notion of Vedana that we've talked about so much in our conference. They use a character which is sho, which means literally to receive or to accept something. And thus, I think in the Sinitic world sphere, the way they would think about Vedana is more like a receptivity to experience in some sense. But there are, and there also are many discussions in these days and materials of what this show is that derive for, in large part from translations of earlier Indic materials. These track very closely with what we have been hearing so far in the course of our conference. But there are also in Chinese many other terms, and a certain term I'm going to talk about in just a bit, which also are associated with ideas of feelings or sensation, that these terms won't map very easily onto this Indian notion of Vedana. And probably foremost among these is the Chinese term qing, which is a polysemous term that conveys English concepts that are more closely aligned perhaps with emotion or emotional feeling, but which also denotes such ideas as sensibility, as physical sensation, and so forth. You know, we in the West have explored a whole range of terms that are related to emotional sensibilities. We have even feeling, of course, but sentiment, pathos, affect. We've explored this in a variety of languages, classical Greek and Latin, all the modern European languages. But in Sinitic or East Asian philosophy, all of this kind of discussion takes place through the vehicle of the one term, the one sinograph, qing. When this term is used in rendering Indian materials, it most commonly translates general categories, such as manas, would be the mentality, or sattva, living creature, indriya, a faculty of some sort. And among the most common usages we have, I can evoke here Xuanzang, whom Musang is here somewhere, I think. Yes, there he is. He invoked him on the first day of our conference, actually, as the great translator of Indian Buddhist materials. And what he did, especially, was to try to come up with new, more precise, and especially etymologically accurate translations of Buddhist materials into Chinese that would track as far as was linguistically possible, the etymological background of an Indian term. So where we had the old term translation for sattva of all sentient beings, zhongsheng, he came up with the term youqing, to have sensibility, literally, which was an attempt to translate this term sattva, which comes from the root sat, to exist in a sense. And so this was Xuanzang's great achievement, was to try to re-render Indian Buddhism in terms that would more accurately represent to the Chinese what the Indians themselves actually meant by these terms. We're doing something similar at this conference, but rather than trying to remap in terms of etymology, we're trying to remap in terms of sort of modern psychological discourse instead, by trying to move away from some of the old, perhaps outmoded translations of Vedana as feeling or sensation to feeling tone, hedonic tone, and so forth. I have only one warning, which is that Xuanzang's translations, as accurate and precise as they are never read, precisely because they're unreadable as Chinese to an ordinary Chinese person. And so as accurate as they are, and as well as they represent what the Indians themselves often thought, this turned out to be of not much interest to the Chinese. They liked the older translations better because it made sense to them. So we may find the same thing when it comes to feeling and sensation, I'm afraid. We also see in the term qing, this term for sensibility or emotional sensibility in Chinese, also deployed to render some strong emotional, even sort of instinctual reactions, such as in rendering the term maituna, you know, pairedness or really sexual intercourse, as qing qing se, or carnal desire almost, sneha. We see qing used here in this translation means something like unctuousness or lubricity, so sort of tenderness or affection, abhilasha. Let's see, qing qing xin, this would be sort of affection, desire, even perhaps emotional exuberance, which would track more closely the connotations of the Chinese term. What I'm going to do here today is to look at one of the most distinctive and really quite unique deployments of this Chinese term qing, emotional sensibility, in the context of a very peculiar sort of sensation, what is called the sensation of doubt, the I Ching. And this is probably the core principle, the core catalyst that is used in the course of a kind of meditation that I think we in the West would commonly know as sort of koan meditation, following the Japanese Buddhist model. This starts off in China and almost simultaneously in Korea, in fact. And there it has a quite specific name. They don't use the term koan, which is a Japanese term. They use instead the term kanhua. Kan means literally to look at, and the Chinese character is literally a hand over an eye, you know, staring off into the distance, looking at something, examining something. And the hua would be a word, literally, but it's used to refer to a meditative topic, and I'll explain what that means in just a bit. So this kanwa sun that I'll be talking about means literally the sun or the zen, actually the dhyana, because this is a transcription actually of an Indian term. So the sun of sort of examining a meditative topic. In this technique, they would use stories about earlier masters, and these are the stories which we know in the West now as koans. This is from a Chinese term, gongan, which interestingly is originally a legal term. It comes out of Chinese law, and it means something like a case or a precedent in law. It's a case because this is an exchange between a master and typically a disciple, in which the master will make some sort of enigmatic statement about the reality of enlightenment to his student, which the student typically is going to be either befuddled by completely or else enlightened by from having heard those words. So this is a way of sort of establishing a precedent in the tradition, how you describe enlightenment. And so these cases or koans are used, they were used originally as sort of a testing mechanism or a pedagogical technique, a way of teaching students or testing students' understanding. But when these cases are examined by applying the sensation of doubt to them, and doubt here really means sort of questioning, and I'll explain why that is in a bit, they turn from a gongan or a koan into a huadu, into a meditative topic at that point. So that's what this term really means, huadu or huatou in Chinese. It means really using a case not as something to think about what enlightenment means, but as a way of sort of raising that sense of wonder, inquiry, questioning in yourself then. These public cases, or these koans, were, oh, I should also mention, this is sort of fun too, this term koan, you know, it means a precedent or a case, but it comes also to be used as to refer to a kind of Chinese fiction genre, detective stories or legal procedures. So, you know, if you watched L.A. Law or Perry Mason today, that would be sort of a modern gongan story, actually, in fact, in the way it's used in the later Chinese tradition. So these cases then are significant, not just because they're repositories of Sun's pedagogical lore, but also and primarily because they express in some quite distinctive and unique fashion as a precedent what the enlightened understanding of the Zen master who is part and parcel of this case had. So students were then taught to use these sort of topics, these cases as a topic of inquiry. Sometimes you'll see this translated as critical phrase or keyword in Western languages, so that they too would come to realize and in turn be able to express then their own enlightened state of mind. This single-minded attention to the huadu, this question about the case then, this topic, was thought to create a kind of introspective focus that would eventually lead the student back to his or her own enlightened source of mind. This is a process which the Chan people, some people call tracing back the radiance, this hui guang fan jiao, to trace the radiance emanating from the mind back to its source. So you discover the source of the mind itself. Sometimes called counter-illumination, which I sort of like. So once students have rediscovered the source of their own minds through this counter-illumination, they would come to know what the enlightened intent of the Sun Master involved in the public case was, and in turn consummate in themselves that same state of enlightenment. So in a sense then, what this technique does is allow students to pattern their minds after those of the eminent Sun Masters of old until ultimately they think and finally act as one. So when you solve the koan, I think this is one of the big misconceptions we have in the West, we presume we're looking for an answer to the koan. In the Japanese tradition, that is the case. But the way the term and the way the technique was deployed in China and Korea before, long before the Japanese pick it up, is the koan the koan and the wadu, in a way, are essentially a way of patterning yourself after the teachers of old, so that you're not looking to acquire an answer. You're going to acquire the state of mind of the master when he gave that answer. And therefore, you would understand immediately that's what he meant by saying that. And you could then give your own response, which may be exactly the opposite of the master. You may, in fact, this is, Zen lore is filled with these examples and counterexamples where masters say, well, if I had been there, I would really have said this instead. And they'll give like 5, 6, 7 different examples of what you could say. So it isn't a search for an answer, it's a search for a state of mind, the state of mind from which these cases derive then. It's a Chan teacher in the 12th century, a man named Dahui Zonggao, who transforms gongans or koans into this new meditative approach, which he calls Kanwasan, the sun of examining these topics. This particular technique then places pride of place on the need for doubt, which is viewed as the motive force that propels this meditation forward. Probably the best known of all these gongan is the first case that appears in the Wumenguan, the gateless checkpoint. This is a collection of Zen koans. This is the one Anne referred to in her talk. Once a student came to a teacher named Jiaozhou, and he asked the master, "Does a dog have Buddha nature or not?" And the master answered, "Doesn't have it. Mu wu." We often translate this as no, but it really means it's a verb, actually, which means doesn't have it. That's the wrong answer. According, as Anne described, and this is the foundation of the East Asian tradition as well, all of us have this capacity for enlightenment, this capacity for realization, which we call Buddha nature. So the correct answer should have been, when he was asked, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? He should have said, yo, of course he has it. Instead, he says, no. So the question is, why would an enlightened teacher, out of his peculiar enlightened state of mind, have given what is clearly the wrong answer to a very obvious question like this? That's what raises the sense of inquiry. What would he have meant by saying no when the right answer, obviously, is yes? That's where we start. A dog, like any sentient being, is blessed with this fundamental quality of sentience. This is what the tradition calls numinous awareness, which is the same as that of all the Buddhas, and thus everyone has Buddha nature. And that's one of the big secrets that I discovered in the course of doing Kanwasan training and studying this tradition, is that when we talk about Buddha nature, this is not some arbitrary, concept that's just made up out of whole cloth. What Buddha nature really means is, what is the quality that's most fundamental to all Buddhas and all sentient beings? It's the quality of sentience. The fact that I see you, you see me, I hear the fans turning, you experience whatever you're experiencing now, all this is sentience. It's our ability to experience our world. The fact that we're sentient beings is proof of our Buddha nature. That's what we're trying to recover. We've just managed to convince ourselves, quite stupidly in some real sense, over not only this lifetime, but multiple lifetimes in the past, that we are not Buddhas, but we're actually deluded sentient creatures who need to suffer, who need to experience impermanence, who are forced to go through this cycle of birth and death, when in fact the reality is not this delusion that we are experiencing all the time, but the reality of our sentience, our awareness. Well, Anne called it this open horizon sort of state of mind. That's the state of mind that the Sun School is trying to develop in the course of their training. So going back to this question, why would this teacher, Jiaozhou, have said no to this question of whether a dog has Buddha nature or not? Well, the answer quite obviously should be yes, he does have it. So in using this case, this precedent, as a meditative topic, he tells his students not to undertake any sort of literary analysis or doctrinal unpacking of the case. This is what you would see in the koan collections, and what was done with koans before Dahui's time, actually. These were used as sort of a pedagogical tool, so they would go through and analyze the cases. There is probably no more elaborate commentarial genre than the koan collections of the Zen school. Zen claims to be a tradition that does not rely on words and letters. Quite ironically, it has the largest body of literature of any school of East Asian Buddhism. So it's very interesting that it turns out this way. But you can see why, because you collect all these answers, alternative answers, explanations. This is what koans, how they were used before Dahui's time. Dahui says, forget all that. And in fact, not only forget all that, he takes the wood blocks, the xylographs, from which his teacher had printed the largest Gongan collection that exists, the Blue Cliff Records, and he has them burned because he says, this is not what we're doing. What Gongans are for is to develop the Huadu, the question of doubt regarding these questions, and that's where we should focus. So this is what he means when he says you have to examine Khan, the question of, or the topic of, why would Zhao Zhu have said no when the correct answer is yes? That's what you're investigating. Investigating these statements, these sorts of statements, these huadu now, would help to generate a strong sense of inquiry or questioning, which the Kanwa Sun tradition variously calls the mind of doubt, the wixin, or the sensation of doubt, the yijing or wijang. Now, doubt, we know, doubt is quite prominent in Indian Buddhist texts, vichikitsa, meaning more, however, a kind of skepticism. It's a hindrance. It's one of the five hindrances to the experience of dhyana, in fact, and it has to be overcome in order to experience deep levels of meditative absorption. So doubt really doesn't play any constructive role in Indian Buddhist spiritual culture, but instead it was an obstacle that one had to overcome if progress was to proceed. But by the time this notion of doubt has been fully apprised and considered in the East Asian tradition by Dahui and other Sun adepts after him, what was originally a debilitating mental concomitant, a chaita or chetasika, has been transformed into the principal force that drives one toward enlightenment. Interestingly, doubt is a pretty good translation, I think, of what the Chinese term actually means. But if you look at the way that it's described in the literature, there really are two quite different denotations to this notion of doubt. On the one hand, we have this positive denotation, wonder about the nature of the world, this questioning, this sense of inquiry, of wanting to know, why did Zhao Zhou say no and the answer is yes? But also, you've got, at the same time, this very frustrating negative connotations of puzzlement, bewilderment, even frustration and anxiety, because you're not able to understand what this expression meant, even though you bring to the fore all of your expertise, all of your intellectual knowledge, all of your doctrinal background on Buddhism, all of your concentration, nothing is doing it, and you can't figure it out. And so you get very frustrated from this. And so Dahui defines this sense of doubt, actually, as a state of mental perplexity, he says, where the intellect cannot operate and thought cannot reach. It's the road through which discrimination is excised and theorizing is ended. He says, and this is quite evocative, he says, it makes the mind puzzled, frustrated, and insipid, just as if you were gnawing on a cold iron rod. That's the joy of Kanwa Sun meditation. And it feels just like that sometimes. But one of our charts from one of our past presentations, and if you lose me which one it was, had boring on one side and all the way over on the other. And Kanwa Sun is definitely starts over on the boring side, because you go at it and go at it and go at it again. And finally, you're just not getting anywhere, so you get bored with it, you get frustrated with it, and all that actually is good, in fact, in Kanwa Sun. So this inability to understand what Zhao Zhou could possibly have meant by giving his student the wrong answer further strengthens this sense of inquiry. So by continued attention to this insipid wadu, the student ultimately despairs at making any further attempts at exerting his or her intellect and learning and attempting to understand it. It brings thoughts to an end. You try and try and try again, trying to figure out, trying to understand it. You go to your teacher. You say, I think I got it now. Here's my answer. He says, wrong. Go out a bit, get it again. You come back again. He says, wrong. Hit you with a stick. Go back and think about it some more. So you keep doing this over and over and over again until finally you frustrate yourself at your own inability to really get this. And this is the point, actually, that's very crucial in Kanwasa meditation, which you get to that point of extremely deep frustration. And I'll talk about that as I go on in my talk, actually. One of the most systematic presentations we have of this role of doubt in mature Kanwasan practice appears in a text that, one of my favorite texts actually, it's called The Essentials of Chan by an influential Linji or Rinzai teacher during the 13th century in China. This is used actually, this text, The Essentials of Chan, is used as sort of a primer of Kanwasan meditation in Korea. It's one of the texts that they read in Korea before beginning Kanwasan meditation. So they sort of understand the system, how it works, what's expected, what to expect and so forth. One of the distinctive aspects of this Essentials of Chan is he talks about Chan practice in terms of what he calls its three principal constituents, what he calls the three essentials. And these are the faculty of great faith, the great fury, or perhaps something like passionate intent, sometimes translated more salutarily as great zeal, but I think actually it really is ferocity, fury, almost anger, even self-loathing in some context. And the third is the great sensation of doubt. And then we just give you a very short passage where he actually defines each of these in quite distinctive sort of the sun argo of Buddhism. Since if we're speaking about authentic sun contemplation, there have to be these three essentials. The first essential is to have the faculty of great faith. So here's how he defines it. He says, this matter, meaning the matter of birth, death, and enlightenment, this matter should be so patently obvious that it's just as if you're leaning against Mount Sumeru. I'll explain this in a bit. The second essential is to have great fury, which is just as if you've come across the villain who has murdered your father, and right then and there you want to cut that man down with a single slice of your sword. Here we do have some martial imagery. Somebody asked in a previous session about this, and you do see in some texts some rather vivid martial imagery, even some violence, in fact. The third essential is to have the great sensation of doubt. And this is a quite interesting definition. He says, this is just as if you've done some heinous act in secret and are about to be exposed. They're going to find out what you did. Okay. So let me unpack this a bit. The doctrinal foundation of virtually all of East Asian Buddhism, just as it was in Tibet much later, and especially in the Sun tradition, was the claim that enlightenment was something that was imminent in all people, as expressed in the term Buddha nature. As Yuan Miao explains it in this Essentials of Chan, ultimately, all we needed to do to achieve enlightenment was simply to accept that fact, to have faith in that reality, have faith in it wholeheartedly, and thereby let go of this mistaken delusion we've created for ourselves that we are not right here, right now, enlightened. Faith is the catalyst for this change of heart. And faith here really means everything, you know, a whole range of connotations from confidence to faith to acceptance almost in some sense to acquiescence really in some sense also, I think. Faith was a catalyst because it was a beneficial influence that's constantly emanating from the enlightened nature, which is prompting all sentient beings back toward what their true nature actually is. So it's beckoning us back. It isn't something we have to discover. We simply have to recover it, to kind of uncover it, even though it's already there. The supreme confidence that would be generated by this kind of faith would make it seem just as if you were leaning against Mount Sumeru, as he says in this text. This is the axis mundi of the world in the Indian cosmological scheme. Once one's faith was sufficient, the student would immediately acquiesce to his or her own original nature of mind and would recognize and be better recognize one's innate enlightenment. So faith was conceptualized in Sun Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, as being the principal catalyst of awakening. But I think what's quite interesting in the Zen school, and especially in this Kanwasan tradition, is that on the one hand you say, yes, we all enlightened, we all have this prospect of awakening. That's all true. But they also have a realistic view of the human condition, which is, while people may in truth be enlightened right here, right now, we've had many years, in fact many lifetimes in the Buddhist sense, to convince ourselves otherwise. So therefore, it was perfectly natural to expect that even the most sincere adepts would have doubts about the truth of their own innate enlightenment, about their capacity to rediscover that truth, and about the ability of their teacher to guide them toward that rediscovery and their ability to follow that path. So I think in a quite striking accommodation to the frailty of human nature, rather than make the perfection of faith alone the prerequisite to enlightenment, Sun develops an approach to practice that draws on the very doubts that most religious adherents would inevitably experience. They expect you to have doubts. They expect you to be frustrated at times. They expect you to be bored. So how do you put all of those emotions to use in the course of this? That's what the sensation of doubt is really all about in the tradition. So Sun is trying to use this natural tension between faith, the faith that I accept, I have confidence in this fact, this truth, that I am right here, right now, innately enlightened. I'm here right now, a Buddha. I have faith in that. But also, I have doubt. I certainly don't seem to be acting enlightened right now. I seem to be more of a deluded ordinary person rather than enlightened. So you use this tension between faith and doubt as the catalyst for the experience of awakening then. So in this Essentials of Chan also, he talks about how these two factors are in symbiotic relationship. So he says it's certain that the more faith you have, the more doubt you're going to have too. So the stronger your faith is, the stronger your doubt is. That's a very, very unusual statement, I think, in the context of religious practice. He says, for example, that faith is the essence of doubt. Faith is the source from which doubt arises, because if you didn't have that confidence you were enlightened, you wouldn't have doubt arising about the fact that right now you're not enlightened, or think you're not enlightened. At the same time, the functioning of that doubt is to create awakening. So he uses this old essence-function distinction that is basic to Chinese Buddhist and kind of larger philosophy as well, as to describe this tension between faith, doubt, and enlightenment then. So this religious doubt arises from the deepest recesses of one's faith then. This tension between them creates a kind of existential quandary that ultimately leads to this experience of breaking openness, this awakening that you talk about. And all these three factors are inextricably interconnected. So in this Essentials of Chan, he says, when faith is 100%, so too will be doubt. When doubt is 100%, so too will be awakening. So let me give you an example from his own text, his own autobiography, in fact, of how this sensation of doubt manifests in practice. He says, unexpectedly in my sleep, I began to doubt the huadu, the question, the thousand dharmas return to one. To what does the one return? It is at that point the sensation of doubt suddenly erupted. I stopped sleeping. I forgot about eating. I couldn't distinguish east from west. I couldn't tell day from night. Whether spreading out my sitting mat or lying out my bowls, whether defecating or urinating, finally whether active or still, speaking or silent, everything was just, to what does this one return? There wasn't the slightest extraneous thought, and even if I wanted to think of something else, I couldn't do it. It says, my mind was exactly like something nailed or glued. No matter how hard you shook it, it would not move. From dusk till dawn, from dawn till dusk, my mind became lucid and profound, lofty and imposing, pristine and flawless. All terms that come out of the Chinese literary tradition, in fact. One thought seemed to last for 10,000 years. All the sense realms became completely tranquil, and all persons and sense of self were forgotten. It was as if I was stupid or senseless. from all this. So this existential doubt that's created through investigating one of these questions, raising this question, becomes the locus around which all the other doubts experienced in life coalesce. This overwhelming sense of doubt produces an intense pressure on the meditator's intellectual processes, and finally on one's own sense of self-identity and self-worth. The coalescence of all your thoughts and actions around just this sense of doubt produces an intense sensation of courage, the courage you need to abandon yourself seemingly to ultimate disaster, your own personal destruction, to experience non-self in the Buddhist tradition. This courage is what he means by the second of his three essentials, this great fury I talked about. This is sometimes translated as great zeal in a more salutary way, but I think that rendering misses the strong sense of antipathy and disgust. From my own experience, sometimes it even bordered on kind of self-loathing. You know, you stupid, why can't you figure this out, you know? You get really mad at yourself, actually. That can be generated through kanwasan practice. So great fury means just that. You get mad at yourself, if necessary, for your inability for all these days, months, and maybe years, or in my case, decades of practice in trying to understand the Hwadu. And this is why, in my experience, sometimes kanwasan can feel like going through a personal encounter session at times, rather than some calming meditative sort of retreat. This fury creates a strong urgency about religious practice that becomes so intense, as he said, it's just as if you've come across the villain, pardon me, who murdered your father. You know, very intense passion. So this strong fury or passion is going to sustain the student through the existential crises that are created by raising this sense of questioning or doubt. Through this sustaining power from this fury, the doubt will not dissipate, but it becomes increasingly intense. And then just as a filial son would want to avenge his father's murder without concern for his own life, so too would the meditator want to investigate the Hwadu until he no longer could resist the mental pressure that's created by that doubt, that questioning. At that point, the texts say the doubt explodes. It's exactly the term they use, to blow up, to explode. And in the doubt blowing up, what is also blowing up is your own sense of personal self-identity, because you have put all of yourself into this question over this very intense period of questioning meditation. And when the doubt explodes, therefore your own sense of self-identity explodes, the bifurcating tendencies of thought come to an end, which eliminates the point of view that is the constructed sense of self in the Buddhist view, and restores the mind's inherent state of enlightenment. At that point, the student is said to have accessed the same state of mind as have the previous patriarchs of Sun when they uttered these enigmatic statements in these cases or in these questions. And the student will then fully understand exactly why they said that. They'll know exactly what they meant by saying that. At that point, the mind of the patriarch is, and this is the term they often use in the tradition, you get stamped, you get sealed, the seal of approval almost, on the student's mind, which initiates the student into this, what they call the mind-to-mind transmission, which that is said to go back to the Buddha himself, where this sense of enlightenment has been passed along through experiencing this from generation to generation. So through this continued investigation of the Hwadu, the student can forego all the gradual stages of religious development and get to the very root of the problem of samsara, exposing the fallacy of a personal point of view, a self, an atman or atta, a fallacy that's proliferated throughout all of our sensory experience through conceptualization, prapancha, and its dichotomizing tendencies. And this is where I think the quality of concentration that you see in kanwasan is quite a bit different from at least the way I have understood vipassana to be. Vipassana, and especially like as you see it described in the Satipatthana Sutta, it's a very close focus on a specific point, such as the point on the nostrils or on the upper palate where you feel the breath going in and out. So you try to really focus concentration. What doubt is doing is not focusing at all. There isn't a focus. It's a doubt without a focus. It's a concentration without a focus, which means that the doubt kind of envelops you instead. You're not focusing on doubt. You're experiencing the doubt all around you. And in fact, it's a palpable sensation that pervades the entire body at times as well. So rather than focusing at one point, you're sort of opening your horizons, as Anne described it in her paper. You open up very wide like this instead. When this happens, one's awareness now has no fixed locus. The distinctions between oneself and others vanish. Consciousness expands infinitely, encompassing both the entire universe spatially and temporally. This is the meaning of enlightenment in this system. So this is why Yuan Miao can claim that enlightenment means simply to resolve this one doubt. 1,000 doubts, 1,000,000 doubts, he says, are just this one doubt. And you, if you resolve this doubt, you'll have nothing more that you doubt any longer. And once you have no further doubt, you will be neither more nor less than Shakyamuni, Maitreya, Vimalakirti, Elder Pang, so forth and so on there. And so doubt, Kanwa-san is explicitly trying to foster mental stress, existential quandary, even emotional anxiety, all states that are suggested in the way he describes the sensation of doubt as being like you've done some heinous act in secret and are about to be found out. It's therefore perhaps no surprise that when you look at the literature on Kanwa-san, very often the instructions are not being made to monks, they're being made to lay people. Because lay people have all kinds of opportunities to have mental stress, existential quandary, emotional anxiety, frustration, on and on down the line. So in some sense, the ordinary world provides the ideal petri dish in which to experience all these negative emotions that can be put to the use in service of mastering, breaking through that one doubt of the gongan. And so actually it's quite interesting. If you look at Dahui's own writings, we often think in the way this practice develops over the centuries that it's a focus on certain specific questions that come up in the literature. Does a dog have Buddha nature or not? No. Whatever it might be. What's the true meaning of Buddhism? You know, cypress tree in the courtyard. These are all useful tools of doubt, but actually Dawei says quite clearly, he says sometimes, you know, you're reading a passage in the sutras and something doesn't quite make sense to you, and a doubt will arise from that. Or you're doing something and you can't quite figure out, why am I doing it this way? What's the whole point of this? All those sort of questions can kind of coalesce around this one great doubt of a huadu or gongan as it develops. And this is why I think in household life, he says this quite clearly, a person who is able to withstand these kind of pressures and put them to use in the service of practice can develop a tremendous li, a power or dynamism, I think is a better translation, which was claimed to be superior to that even of the sequestered monk. So, what does it have to do with Vedana? What are the connections between this sensation of doubt and traditional Indian notions of Vedana? Here I'm going to have to be going back and forth across this divide separating the Indian and East Asian accounts of meditation. So from here on, it's all speculative fancy. Bear with me. As we've seen before, the technique of Kanwa-san demands that this sensation of doubt become utterly compelling to the meditator and all-encompassing in the mind, so that no other sensations of thought or thoughts are allowed to intrude on this single-minded concentration on the huadu. And this is the point where you have this inward focus developing that the tradition calls tracing back the radiance, back to the source of mind instead. This experience often marks what some teachers call the transition from a sensation of doubt, where you have this palpable feeling of questioning, wondering that kind of pervades your body, to an experience of a ball of doubt, where that doubt gets somehow very strong and tight, and often manifesting as tightness in the chest, for example. And I'll talk about that in just a bit. This is sometimes likened to something that gets stuck in your chest or throat, which creates an intense physical reaction, a very unpleasant Vedana, in fact. In The Essentials of Chan, he describes this as follows. He says, keep on doubting until right here and now, internal and external, both fuse into a singularity or into a single mass without leaking even one iota the whole day long. He says, it'll be like a fishbone stuck in your chest that makes you feel like you've ingested poison. He says, furthermore, you must be determined to bore through this ring of adamant, like kind of a diamond ring that's surrounding you, or swallow down a cluster of thorny chestnut burrs. It isn't just the chestnut itself, it's the casing of the chestnut, which has all these stickers coming out of it that you're trying to swallow down, but you can't swallow them, you can't spit them up, they're just stuck right there. This sensation of choking or tightness in the chest can manifest in Kanwasan as shortness of breath or as a shallow, fitful breathing, almost as if the meditator is gasping for air, just like as if you had a chestnut burr stuck in your throat that you can't spit up or swallow down. This stage of extreme concentration in Kanwasan is also sometimes accompanied by intense shaking, twitching, or tingling of the body, which may go on for many minutes or hours, or in some cases even days, in particularly intense cases. The worst I ever had of this was I was working on a huadu, and just getting nowhere with it at all. Just more and more and more frustrated. And I was in a small retreat with a teacher who had invited to sit with his monks. I think we had five professors, and none of us were getting it. Nobody was getting anywhere. So he did kind of an intervention for the professors. He had us in and said, look, you know, this is going to work. You can have confidence. You can figure this out. Just stop thinking. He says, cut off your head. Meditate from the neck down instead. And he says, this will work. The only case it won't work is if you don't have any affinities with this practice and any causes and conditions. And so I heard that and I said, you know, I've been doing Kanwasan for decades now. I've been sitting here for 3 days with you, just getting nowhere. You know, I think I just don't have any affinities with this training. You know, it must be that. And I just completely broke down. And just total embarrassment, went back to my room, just crying my eyes out, actually. And was sitting there, it's about 10 o'clock at night, just more and more and more frustrated and angry and loathing and just really about to give up on the whole thing. And my wife sort of walked in, and I said, I can't face her. I said, I'm walking out. I'm going to figure this out. It's now or never. You know, it's kind of one of those sort of points where you get to in your life. And went back to the hall, and I said, I'm going to sit here. I am not going to move, goddammit, until I figure this out. I really got angry. And as I was beginning to develop, finally, a sense of, you know, frustration, puzzlement, questioning, all coming up at once, I began to feel this very slight twitching in my right arm. And I thought, well, that's a little strange, but, you know, sometimes you twitch a little bit and you have a little reaction, no big deal. And within about 30 seconds, suddenly my entire body was sort of just shaking like this. So that over the course of the next hour or so, I was sitting on my cushion, but my cushion literally moved about a foot forward and 3 feet to the right. I was twitching so much during this time. But this was when the doubt became extremely intense, actually. I felt like I was, like this doubt had totally encased me, as if I were in a very deep black well, almost. That was sort of the feeling. I was sitting down here, and I'm sitting in this deep well, totally shut in. It wasn't really painful. It wasn't unpleasant. I realized I was twitching, but it didn't really bother me. I just said, I'm going to sit through this doubt until I get through this, finally. And as I was sitting there, shaking all the time, I guess, I had this experience that amidst this enveloping blackness of this doubt, I saw a little bit of light begin to appear as if it were at the top of the well. So looking up at that well and saying, oh, there's some light up there. Well, that's interesting. And then suddenly, all the walls of this well began to crack, and just light poured in from the outside until just everything was just brightness. And I guess at this point, the Zen master came in, and he yelled in my ear. He said, oh! And startled me a little bit. And he said, okay, that's enough. You know, kind of calm down now. And so I sat there and I said, well, actually, I feel okay, I think. But I still have a little bit of doubt left, though. So I think I'm gonna go through this. And so I began to kind of go back into the doubt. And at a certain point then, I began to sort of feel as if I were looking through this picture window in the whole expanse of the universe around me. And as I looked out, all I saw was this plasma field in all directions, just energy in all directions, all around me, above, below, all the way, all through, everywhere. And I realized when I saw this that my doubt was gone now, finally. The doubt had been resolved. And I looked at this and I said, oh my God, this is the Buddha nature. And I just laughed out loud. And I laughed for about 20 minutes straight. I guess I fell back on my cushion just laughing at the top of my lungs. And again, they brought the Zen master in. And then he said, he whispered on your ear, he said, stop. You know, not stop, but stop. In the Korean style. And then I began to sort of come out of it at that point. But I continued to shake. My body was still sort of like as if you had a fever almost throughout the entire night after this. And my wife actually was so worried, she sort of laid down behind me, holding me, trying to see if she could get me to calm down a little bit. And it was just the most amazing experience, actually, that I've ever had through Kanmas. I've had other things through Kanmas, but this was really, for me, a real personal breakthrough. And it came about from this notion, from this sense of total frustration, anger at yourself, and then the tightness that becomes so tight that it creates kind of this physical sensation. Let me go back to this now. So, if you look at accounts of vipassana or samatha training, in fact, you'll see that often there are such accounts of this shaking or twitching that occur. And these are typically described as manifestations of piti or priti, which is the third of the five constituents of dhyana, the five factors of dhyana that are discussed in the mainstream literature. Priti refers to the primarily physical response that accompanies the first and second levels of dhyana. Its physical dimension is too coarse for the more refined third dhyana, where you're left only with mental ease, kind of relaxation like Anne described, and one-pointedness of mind. So it's too coarse for that, so it drops out at that point. You often see priti described as bliss or rapture or joy, zest. And these are all, you know, quite salutary ways of thinking about it. But I think it manifests often, even in literature described this way, as a kind of physical reaction, a horripilation, your body hair standing on end. In its most intense stages, pliti becomes so uplifting that your body seems as if to levitate almost. But these uplifting dimensions of priti as kind of a spiritual rapture can sometimes be overwhelmed and overshadowed by rather less delightful experiences. And here's one description. These include strange involuntary movements, for example, a pronounced trembling, intermittent jerking, or creeping goose flesh. This was from Roderick Bucknell, who trained in Burma with the Vipassana teachers there. He says it leads to a rocking or swaying of the body like this that becomes so intense you're actually vibrating to the point where others will be able to see it. Or even, this was Lee Brasington, who's sort of the jhana guy these days. He said it leads to a kind of severe shaking. In samatha practice, this priti or piti is said also to make the breath very rough with a short, sharp gasp. This comes also from Brasington. And this is exactly what I've seen happen in the case of Kanmasa meditation, in fact, this very, very rapid, quick breathing like that. So rather than rapture, I've been toying with the idea of rendering priti as perhaps something like excitation, so as to encompass these more intense physical reactions that at times hardly seem rapturous. Bucknell, following Buddhadasa, has described, this is a Thai Thai forest teacher. He describes preeti as being bifurcated between excitation or preeti that's born of isolation associated with the first jhana, and excitation or preeti born of concentration, samadhi japriti, which is associated with the second jhana. He says, the effort required to maintain the concentration of the object of meditation needs to be dialed back as one-pointedness develops. Otherwise, the excess manifests, he says, in the form of uncontrolled physical movements. If this is not done, this concentration-born excitement, or excitation, can lead, he says, to physical trembling, whose cause is the maintaining of a high level of attentive focusing after it's no longer needed, i.e. after one-pointedness has been established. So as I mentioned, I've seen all these dimensions produced during Kanwasan practice as well. The shaking, twitching, trembling, almost as if you're suffering from a severe fever. And in fact, in some intensives, some Kanwasan retreats or intensives, these involuntary physical reactions are so commonplace that they're seen as a sign of having, in fact, made progress in raising this doubt. So this is where I say, in my case, it was when you raise that sense of zeal or fury that actually that's when the preeti began to develop in the course of the doubting, as you coalesce around this sense of doubt. Preeti is a bit of an anomaly in Buddhism, as I think. Akinchenyo who mentioned preeti does appear in the list of mental concomitants, the chetasikas in Pali. But if you look in other strands of mainstream Buddhism, Sarvastivada, and even in Yogacara, preeti doesn't appear as one of the dharmas. You would have expected to appear as one of the chaita dharmas, perhaps one of the aniyatas, the indeterminate factors. But in fact, it's also the only one of the five constituents of dhyana that doesn't appear as an independent dharma and all the other dharma lists of Buddhist schools. So if it isn't a dharma into itself or unto itself, as all the other factors of jhana are, what would it be? I think preeti has to be thought of as a kind of vedana. And in this case, vedana we know is one of the 10 omnipresent mental factors, the chaita mahabhumikas in Savastivada. Not so preeti, same in Yogacara essentially. So I would think preeti may be classified as a type of otherworldly vedana, one of these vedanas that is free from carnality, the niramisa vedana. Niramisa vedana that we talked about before as the sensation that is not of the flesh, or a non-carnal sensation. This is, I think, something Akinchenyo brought up at one point. In the eponymous Niramisa Sutta, this is used to describe both preeti and sukha, physical rapture, mental ease and bliss, and is defined as an experience associated with the dhyanas. So given this palpable physical sensation that accompanies the intensification of concentration in both Kanwasan and in Vipassana, I think we may have in this Niramisa Vedana, this Vedana that is not of the flesh, an explicit connection between this characteristic meditative experience in two quite disparate forms of Buddhist meditation. So although the development of the sensation of doubt involves dimensions of sensation that are quite distant from the standard synitic notion of the term ching as an emotion, it also thus does seem to have some mental and physical sensations associated with it that share affinities with certain aspects of this Indic notion of vedana. And we may have here some opportunity, some ways of exploring how you might interpret and compare the processes that underlie both Indian and Sinitic forms of Buddhist meditation. So let me stop there because I'm already past my time. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.